Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling ancient Egypt, but maybe not the Egypt you think you know.
Right. We're trying to move past that sort of static image, you know, the gold masks, the pyramids sitting there like museum pieces.
Exactly. Because this civilization lasted for, what, 3,000 years? That's, well, it's almost impossible to wrap your head around. Longer than the time between Julius Caesar and us today.
It's astonishing longevity. And the big question is how? How did they maintain that stability, that cultural coherence for so long?
And that's where our guide comes in today. We're drawing heavily on the work of the Egyptologist Ian Shaw. He really provides a fantastic shortcut to understanding the mechanics behind it all.
Yeah, his work helps us replace that kind of mythologized picture with something more grounded in evidence, looking at the interplay of, well, geography, politics, and their core beliefs.
So our mission today is basically to understand Egypt on its own terms, as Shaw puts it, to see how those pieces fit together.
And the answer, Shaw suggests, lies in a really sophisticated ideological framework. It centers on the divine king, this cosmic principle called Ma'at, which is like order, justice, truth, and it's all deeply, deeply tied to the Nile River.
You really can't understand Egypt without understanding the Nile, can you?
Not at all. It's fundamental.
Okay, so before we dive deeper into those ideas, maybe tell us a bit more about Ian Shaw himself. Who is he?
Sure. Ian Shaw is a very highly respected British Egyptologist. He's a professor of Egyptian archaeology at the University of Liverpool.
And he's done a lot of field work. I think I read about Amarna.
Yes, exactly. He's known for extensive field work, including at Amarna, which was Akhenaten's capital.
Sure.
But what makes his perspective really valuable, I think, especially for getting a good overview, is his focus on settlement archaeology.
Okay, what does that mean exactly? Mm-hmm. Not just tombs and temples.
Right. He's digging up the everyday stuff, you know, the pottery shards, the tools, looking at how towns were laid out. It gives it this amazing ground-up perspective.
Ah, so it balances out the usual focus on pharaohs and priests.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
You get the view from the palace, sure, but also from the workers' village.
Yeah.
And he's got this dual strength. He's out there doing primary research, getting his hands dirty.
Yeah.
But he's also a brilliant synthesizer.
Yeah.
He edited the Oxford History of Ancient Egypt, which is like the definitive academic overview.
So he can see the big picture and the tiny details. That's a pretty rare combination.
It is. And it means he can distill these incredibly complex topics, 3 millennia of history, into concepts that are still intellectually solid, but, you know, accessible.
Which is perfect for our deep dive.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned his book isn't just a list of kings and dates.
No, thankfully.
Yeah.
That can get really overwhelming, dynasty after dynasty. Instead, he structures it thematically.
Oh, so
he looks at the core pillars of the civilization, things like kingship, religion, art, writing, and, crucially, what life was like for ordinary people.
So it's more about understanding the system.
Exactly. The book aims to equip you with the foundational knowledge to see how it all worked together. His central argument is basically that Egypt's stability wasn't luck. It was the result of this incredibly adaptable institutional framework.
Adaptable. Okay. That seems key.
Very key. This framework managed to fuse political power, the divine king, with religious duty maintaining this cosmic order. Mike Canny. They were two sides of the same coin.
So the king wasn't just like a president or a prime minister. He had a cosmic job description too.
A huge one.
Yeah.
He was responsible for making sure the universe kept running smoothly.
But Shaw doesn't just stay in the realm of ideology. He really brings in the material culture, the social structures, the lives of the 90% who weren't elite.
Right, the people who actually built the pyramids and farmed the land.
Yeah, getting that full picture. Okay, let's dig into some of those pillars then. Starting with kingship and this idea of order, Ma'at. How central was the pharaoh?
Absolutely indispensable. Shaw calls him the linchpin of the cosmos. He wasn't just representing the gods. He was the actual functional connection between the divine world and the human world.
Wow. So his main job was maintaining Maat, this cosmic balance.
Mm-hmm. Maintaining Maat, order, truth, justice against its opposite, Isfet, which is chaos, disorder, lies. And this wasn't just some abstract philosophical thing.
No. How did it work practically?
Well, think about the Nile flood. If it failed or if it flooded too much, that wasn't just bad weather. From their perspective, it was a sign that Maat was disturbed, that chaos was winning.
So the pharaoh's rituals, they weren't just symbolic.
Not entirely. They were seen as practical actions, necessary actions that compelled the gods to do their part, to make sure the sun rose, the Nile flooded predictably, the crops grew. The state's ability to manage the river, to build irrigation, to store grain that was maintaining Marat.
That's fascinating. It connects the ideology directly to, well, infrastructure and bureaucracy.
Exactly. And Shah points to really early stuff, like the Narmer palette from the very beginning of unification, showing the king literally smiting the forces of chaos to establish order. It's baked in from the start.
Okay, so the king is the linchpin. What about the wider religious system? You mentioned the temples were more than just churches.
Oh, much more. We know Egyptian religion was complex, polytheistic. They had this thing called syncretism, where gods merged like Amun and Ra, becoming Amun Ra.
Right.
But the temples themselves were massive economic institutions.
Economic? How so?
They owned huge amounts of land, vast agricultural estates. They ran workshops producing crafts, linen, beer, you name it. They employed thousands of people, priests, administrators, farmers, craftsmen. They were integral to the state's wealth. Think of them almost like state-run corporations intertwined with religious duty.
Wow. So donating to a temple wasn't just piety. It was like investing in a major part of the economy.
In a way, yes. They were centers of redistribution as much as centers of worship.
And what about their focus on death and the afterlife? Mummies, tombs. It seems like an obsession.
Shah argues we need to reframe that. It wasn't really a morbid obsession with death. It was a profound, practical focus on the continuation of life.
Continuation, meaning ensuring life went on after death.
Precisely. Mummification wasn't about being creepy. It was logistics for eternity.
Mm.
They believed you had different soul components, like the ka, your life force, and the ba, your sort of personality or mobile aspect.
Okay.
And for those to function eternally, they needed to recognize the body. So preserving the body was step one in ensuring a successful ongoing existence. It's very practical when you look at it through their eyes.
Practical logistics for the afterlife. That's a very different way of thinking about it. And does that practical functional view extend to their art and architecture too?
Absolutely. Shah really emphasizes this. Egyptian art was fundamentally functional. Aesthetics were secondary.
Functional in what way? Like propaganda?
Partly, yes. Reinforcing the king's power and the cosmic order, but also functional in a more magical sense. Its job was to maintain Maat, to make reality conform to the ideal, and to ensure things lasted for eternity.
Okay, how does that explain the style? You know, the famous look, head in profile, shoulders frontal, legs sideways. It looks kind of flat to us.
Right. That's called composite perspective.
Mm.
And the reason they did it wasn't because they couldn't draw realistically. It was because realism wasn't the point.
What was the point then?
Completeness. Perfection. Eternity. By showing each part of the body from its most characteristic, most recognizable angle, the profile for the head, the front for the torso, they were creating the most complete, perfect, and therefore eternal image of the person or God.
Ah, so it wasn't meant to be a snapshot of a single moment, but like the ultimate timeless version of the subject.
Exactly. It was designed to magically ensure that perfect form existed forever. The art wasn't just depiction. It was creation, or at least preservation for eternity. It's like visual engineering for the cosmos.
Visual engineering. I like that. So we've got the king, the temples, the art, all working to maintain this eternal order. But what about the ordinary people, the other 90%? This is where Shah's settlement archaeology comes in, right?
Yes, and it's absolutely crucial for getting a balanced view. The standout example is Deir el-Medina.
That's the village where the tomb builders lived, for the Valley of the Kings.
That's the one. And because it was in the desert, and these were literate craftsmen, we had this incredible treasure trove of written records they left behind, not on papyrus mostly, but on ostraca.
Ostraca. Those are pieces of broken pottery or limestone flakes they wrote on.
Exactly. Cheap, readily available notepads. And we have thousands of them.
And what do they tell us? Not just official decrees, I assume.
Oh, far from it. They record everything.
Yeah.
Who showed up for work, who was off sick.
Oh.
Personal letters, laundry lists, copies of literary texts.
Laundry lists? Seriously?
Seriously. But also really important stuff, records of legal disputes between villagers, prayers, hymns showing their personal piety. And famously, the details of the first recorded labor strike in history.
A strike in ancient Egypt.
Yep. The workers downed tools stopped working on the pharaoh's tomb because their rations were late or insufficient. They were demanding more fish, vegetables, lamp oil, basic necessities.
Wow. That just makes them seem so real. Complex individuals with grievances and daily struggles.
Completely. It gives us this incredibly detailed, granular window into the lives of ordinary, albeit highly skilled, Egyptians. It shows that this grand ideological system still had to deal with very human, very practical problems on the ground.
Okay, so pulling all these threads together, the king, the religion, the art, the everyday life,
mm-hmm.
what are the main themes or messages that emerge from Shaw's analysis?
Well, the first one we keep circling back to is the Nile. The Nile is the fundamental organizing principle.
Right. It's more than just a river.
So much more. Its predictable flood cycle was the basis for their agricultural wealth. It shaped their calendar, their mythology.
Yeah.
But crucially, managing it required cooperation and organization across the whole length of the country. That geographical reality basically necessitated political unity.
So the river itself almost creates the state structure needed to handle it.
In a very real sense, yes. It makes you wonder, you know, how much modern societies might depend on one single predictable resource or system without fully realizing it.
That's a slightly scary thought. Okay, what's another key theme?
The complete integration of sacred and secular power. We've touched on this, but it's central. Politics and religion weren't separate spheres. They were utterly intertwined.
The pharaoh's dual role again?
Yes. And things like the pyramids or the huge temple complexes. They're obviously acts of religious piety, honoring the gods or ensuring the king's afterlife. But they're also massive state-run economic projects.
Like public works programs.
Exactly. Building a pyramid wasn't just about piling up stone. It required incredible planning, logistics, resource management. It provided work, distributed food, and reinforced the state's power and the pharaoh's divine mandate all at the same time. It's brilliant systems thinking, really. Centralized control in action.
And the third theme, it wasn't all smooth sailing for 3,000 years, was it?
Definitely not. So the third theme is continuity tempered by crisis and change. We talk about stability, but it wasn't rigid. There were the intermediate periods, times when central authority collapsed, the country fragmented.
Chaos, or Isfet, gained the upper hand for a while.
You could say that, but the core culture, the ideology, the institutions, they proved resilient. They adapted. And you even had moments of radical challenge from within, like Akhenaten's religious revolution at Amarna. It didn't last, but it shows that even fundamental beliefs weren't totally set in stone.
So true strength wasn't in never changing, but in being able to recover and adapt after things fell apart.
That seems to be Shaw's point. The system had an inbuilt capacity for regeneration.
Okay, let's maybe pull out a few specific core ideas or, you know, quotable concepts from Shaw's framework that really capture the essence.
Sounds good. Well, one we've discussed is the pharaoh was the indispensable linchpin of the cosmos. His ritual actions were what compelled the gods to maintain universal order.
Right. That really elevates kingship beyond just ruling. It's a cosmic infrastructure maintenance, a pretty high-pressure job.
No kidding. Then there's the idea about the pyramids. The pyramids were not built by slaves, but by a society so well organized that it could mobilize enormous resources.
Yeah, that foots the common script.
Uh-huh.
It emphasizes their administrative genius, their logistical skill, not just brute force.
Exactly. It paints a picture of a highly sophisticated state, even way back in the Old Kingdom.
And one more. Maybe about the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Egyptian religion was not obsessed with death, but with the continuation of life in all its forms.
That really changes the perspective, doesn't it? Away from something morbid and towards, well, a profound commitment to existence itself. An affirmation of life ongoing.
Yes, I think that's a really crucial shift in understanding their worldview.
So thinking about all this, how can we apply these insights today? Are there real-life applications from studying ancient Egypt through Shaw's lens?
I think so. One area is definitely institutional design and adaptability. Shaw's work is basically a 3,000-year case study in how institutions can succeed long-term.
How so?
By showing that successful systems need to maintain their core principles, their own version of Ma'at, you could say, but also be flexible enough to adapt their methods when circumstances change. Like Egypt did during those intermediate periods.
That sounds very relevant for, well, any organization today, from governments to businesses,
yeah.
Balancing tradition and change.
Absolutely. There's also a lesson in cultural literacy, understanding why Egyptian art looks the way it does. Understanding its function teaches you how to read the values and assumptions embedded in the symbols of any culture.
So it's about looking past the surface, whether it's an ancient temple carving or, I don't know, modern advertising or architecture.
Exactly. Asking, what is this for? What message is it designed to convey about order, power, or eternity?
And that ties into the last point, maybe. About sources.
Yeah, critical engagement with sources. Shaw constantly reminds us that our picture of Egypt is built from fragments, and often it's biased towards the elite, the people who could afford stone tombs and inscriptions.
So we always need to ask,
who made this record? Why? And crucially, whose story isn't being told here? Whose voice is missing from this picture? That's critical thinking 101, really. But Egypt provides such a stark example.
Okay, final thoughts. As we wrap up, what was the most surprising thing or the biggest takeaway for you from this deep dive into Shaw's perspective on Egypt?
For me, I think it's the richness of detail we get about the non-elite, especially through things like the Deir el-Medina Ostraca. It populates the landscape. It transforms Egypt from this abstract place of giant monuments and god kings into a society full of actual people with relatable lives and problems. That was really powerful.
Yeah, I agree. It makes it much more human. For me, the most valuable lesson is probably that idea of institutional resilience. The sheer fact that this cultural and political system, built around these core ideas of Maat and divine kingship, could adapt and regenerate over three millennia. That's just mind-boggling. It really offers food for thought about what makes societies, or any long-lasting system, truly endure. It's that balance between stability at the core and flexibility on the surface.
A blueprint for longevity, maybe.
So, a fascinating look at an ancient world with surprisingly modern resonances. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.